Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 23, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Praxis Group's telephone conference call on patent litigation and the federal rules. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest and our special moderator today, Professor Adam Mossoff. He's going to be running the program from this point forward. We intended to have a little Q&A and interview sort of style format between himself, Judge Paul Michel, and Robert Haslam. But then, as always, questions from the audience near the end of the program. We're not yet joined by Robert Haslam, but we did want to begin our program on time, so we're going to do so. Let me turn it over to Professor Adam Mossoff, who is the co-director of academic programs and the senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University School of Law, also a longtime friend of the Federalist Society. Professor Mossoff.
Thank you, Dean, and it's a pleasure to be here today to be moderating what will be a really fun and interesting discussion with the Honorable Paul Michel, former Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and hopefully Robert Haslam will be joining us shortly, who is a partner at Covington & Burling in their Silicon Valley office. I don't believe in spending a lot of time on lengthy lists of accolades and achievements. We have Google and Bing for people who are interested in the long and distinguished histories of both of these very prominent very smart and well recognized individuals who have played very important roles in the patent system. So, welcome, Judge Michel.
Thank you.
So our discussion today will be focusing on patent litigation and the important changes that have been occurring in the federal judiciary that will be impacting the extent to which patent lawsuits are filed and how patents are litigated in the courts. This is part and parcel of what is now becoming a very lengthy, long-standing, multi-year policy debate about the patent system more generally within the United States and its role in America's innovation economy. Much of this discussion, particularly within the bounds of the Beltway here in D.C., has focused less so actually on patents as such, requirements for obtaining them, how owners of patents commercialize them in the marketplace, and instead is focused on patent litigation. Allegations of a patent litigation explosion have been thrown around, and while the data has been challenged, there of course have been some bad actors in the system, as there always have been throughout American history, and of course there's always ways in which we can try to seek to improve the ways in which our patent system, and in particular patent litigation, occurs, and that ensures that it's not abused by the particular bad actors. There has, as I said, been a lot of discussion in the halls of Congress with respect to considered legislation that would actually make changes to patent litigation, but the federal judiciary has not sat by and allowed this discussion to occur without taking note of its role as the judiciary and its constitutional authority under Article 3 of the Constitution, as well as its long-standing discretionary authority to control its docket. Thus, for instance, in the spring of 2014, the Supreme Court, in deciding one of many, many cases that it has decided in the patent law space, changed the rules on the award of fees for prevailing attorneys or for prevailing parties in patent cases, and two cases, companion cases, now known or referred to as Octane Fitness and Highmark, in which they made it easier for the award of fees as well as made it harder to overturn those awards on appeal. Moreover, the judiciary has an important role to play in how it controls its docket through the types of complaints that are filed. And as part of a broader concern and broader reform measures in the federal judiciary as such. Recently, the federal judiciary has actually changed some of the form complaints that plaintiffs use when filing cases in federal court. This includes, along with many, many other types of lawsuits that one might file with respect to particular types of legal rights, the type of complaint that one could file with respect to patent infringement claims. This is historically the form was known as Form 18. It was a bare bones notice pleading type of complaint form. And it was abolished on December 1st of 2015, along with many, many other very bare bones notice pleading type of forms, in preference of a higher standard of pleading with respect to the particular details of the alleged infringement. Interestingly enough, if one takes the practice of actual litigants, their revealed preferences as an indicator of the significance of this change, there was actually a spike in patent infringement filings the business day before the Form 18 was, in fact, removed on December 1st. So on November 30th, there was a record 259 patent infringement filings on that day, a record. A dramatic spike from an average around 20 to 40 lawsuits that are typically filed on a daily basis. It jumped from that to 259, and then immediately on December 2nd went back down to averaging around 20 to 40, which signaled the significance of this change. And moreover, the spike constituted almost entirely of just a few plaintiffs, again, reinforcing the point that perhaps what we see here are some just bad actors in the system, a few bad actors, and that the judiciary is responding to this. So eight plaintiffs accounted for well over half of the total filings on November 30th of 259 cases filed that day. Well, we have, as I mentioned, a very distinguished jurist with us today, former judge of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, to talk about this and many, many other aspects of patent litigation and whether we are actually witnessing today a patent litigation explosion and to what extent is this something that the judiciary has been responding to in terms of the bad actors who might be abusing the system. So without much further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Judge Michelle, who will speak for approximately 10 minutes or so. Hopefully Mr. Hoslin will be joining us shortly, and if not, we'll continue with a more kind of intimate fireside chat type of teleform with Judge Michelle. So, Judge Michelle.
Thank you, Professor Mossoff. I would like to review very briefly about 10 recent developments stemming from the judiciary itself in just the last 2.5 years. Patent reform as a label is usually associated with Capitol Hill activities and lobbying patent reform proposed legislation. But in the last several years, the judiciary has been very active. You mentioned the abolition of Form 18 along with other forms. And the important point is that with that abolition, the applicable law now is the law set forth by the Supreme Court in a pair of decisions called Twombly and Iqbal, which require considerable but not exhaustive fact pleading. So that's one big change, and as you indicated, Professor, that became effective on the 1st of December, so all complaints filed from now forward will have to comply with the much more stringent fact-pleading requirements of the Twombly-Iqbal regime. Another thing to consider is the power of the local patent rules that some 24 districts have adopted for the management of patent cases. Those rules in nearly every case require rather early and very detailed disclosures of contentions of infringement and other issues in a patent case. And even in the districts that do not have local patent rules, nearly all the judges who frequently handle patent cases have standing orders or particular scheduling orders, which likewise set forth in considerable detail the progress at each stage of the case as it moves forward and the requirements placed on the lawyers to provide adequate notice to one another of claims and defenses. And of course, the patent pilot program, active in 14 districts, sends most of the patent cases in those particular districts to a small group of self-volunteering judges who have experience in patent cases, like to try patent cases, and have rapidly growing expertise as a result of that. And it looks to me like the evidence is mounting that those judges are very skillful at weeding out baseless cases at the very earliest stages, including on the complaint. So that's the sort of first development of the last couple years stemming from the judiciary itself. Secondly, with the same effective date of December 1, 2015, new rules sharply narrowing the scope and depth of discovery went into effect. And that should help a lot with the concerns that discovery, if not properly limited, can impose undue costs and delays and disruptions on the parties. So a second important development just a couple months ago, Professor Mossoff made reference to the third big development in the area of shifting fees to the losing party where that party's positions have not been reasonably well supported. So the Octane case lowered the standard. I think it's fair to say lowered the standard. That is, made it easier for district judges to shift fees. And already since Octane, the percentage of cases where fee motions have been granted has tripled. So I take that to be early but strong evidence that Octane is a very significant change. And in a way, Highmark is an even more important decision. I predict that under the abuse of discretion standard mandated by the Highmark case from the Supreme Court, that the affirmance rate of whatever fee-shifting decision the trial judge in his or her discretion makes will be affirmed in a vast majority of cases. I predict over 90% affirmance rate. So fee shifting will be easier, and when it's ordered, it will stick and not be reversed on appeal, except in rare and extreme cases. A fourth line of development concerns, again, the Supreme Court requiring much greater clarity in claim scope, by requiring that claims be more definite. The statute always required it. It wasn't so clear there was a lot of teeth in that requirement. But in the Nautilus case, the Supreme Court greatly strengthened that standard, and it's already beginning to have strong effects to invalidate patents that would not have been invalidated before, at least not on that ground. So a fourth important development. Mention was already made of the fifth big development, which started with Bielski and then gained a great head of steam with the Mayo and Myriad decisions, and then in 2014 with the Alice decision, all strengthening the ability of trial judges to invalidate patents even at the earliest stages for lack of eligibility under Section 101 of the Patent Act. So now we see many motions to dismiss granted right at the beginning of the case because of eligibility defects, and that is, I think, a healthy and certainly a very important development. The sixth area is that now that the IPR and CBM, inter partes review and covered business method review cases have risen in the court system from the Patent Trial and Appeal Board through the Federal Circuit, we see the strength of the review regime that the America Invents Act, the AIA, put in place. So we have a, depending on how you measure it, invalidation rates running from 60 to 90%. So regardless of which measurement method and what you're comparing, a very potent regime of review to invalidate poor patents, and that regime has been upheld by the Federal Circuit pretty much across the board, so that's another major sixth development. The contrast to the legislation is kind of interesting because here we have motions to dismiss being granted on eligibility grounds now rather routinely. The bills would create motions to dismiss for lack of adequately factual pleading, but if the legislation passes, I cannot help but predict that it will create significant churning of motions, because if a motion to dismiss is granted because one of the innumerable little boxes in a complex matrix required by the legislation to have every box filled is granted, the patent owner will simply do further investigation and refile. That may engender yet another motion to dismiss. At that point, the patent owner may be able to prove that any gap in the matrix was a result of information not publicly available. So there'll be one or more motions in almost every case if the legislation passes. But it won't kill the lawsuit, except maybe in a tiny portion of cases. What it will do is add further delay, further expense, further waste of judicial resources. And in a similar fashion, with the fee-shifting provisions of the bills on Capitol Hill, and again, the contrast with the new Octane Highmark regime, fee-shifting motions will become routine. In every case, the winner will feel compelled to file a fee-shifting motion. The loser, whichever side it is, will have to resist that and try to prove that their position or positions were entirely reasonable. I think the end result will be that most of those motions under the statute, if the bills pass, will be denied. So again, the effect is motions churning with the remedy sought not being awarded, and more expense, more delay, more waste of resources of the parties and the courts. And it just goes on from there. So when you compare the efficacy of what the courts are engineering by way of patent reform, if I can use that title, compared with what would happen under the bills, it looks to me like the courts' engineering is much more precise, much better targeted, and avoids the unfortunate effect of burdening all parties in order to try to deter or punish a small number of people engaging in bad conduct. And, you know, when you step back and you think about the local rules, the scheduling orders, and the actual management week by week of a patent infringement case, it involves collaboration between the two trial lawyers and the trial judge. Who of anybody has better expertise, better experience, and a more direct responsibility than those three actors to manage the case, to maximize just result, prompt result, fair result, efficient result? So it looks to me like we want to encourage further collaboration along that line rather than to have heavy-handed, one-size-fits-all mandates dictated by the Congress in an attempt effectively to micromanage patent litigation. And there are systemic problems with the legislation, too. For three-quarters of a century and more, we've had the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and the other federal rules managed under a system where the judiciary was in charge Its rules committees and advisory committee have sought and received enormous input from the litigation bar and from academia, as well as from judges, and made adjustments to the rules from time to time, as they did in the two respects I mentioned earlier, just last December. But the bills, which would sharply undercut that 80-year regime by having the Congress frame rules of procedure, not the judiciary, and worse than that, the Congress creating different procedural rules for patent cases than for every other type of civil case. So there's a risk that the federal rules of civil procedure will be balkanized and split into parts. And of course, if you go down that road, it's inevitable that some other group of litigators will go to Congress and say that for antitrust cases or toxic tort cases or some other type of case, they want separate procedural rules there. So that seems to me to be a very unfortunate road to consider going down. And then finally, the great benefit of the patent system, in my opinion, is that it incentivizes investment. If a company is a small emerging company, it's dependent on repeated infusions of capital from outside funders like venture capitalists, private equity funds, pension funds, and so forth. Or if it's a big company with a strong revenue stream, decisions have to be made as to how much of that revenue stream to invest in research and development and the commercialization of new products, new cures, new advances that improve the lifestyle and the health of our population. So the big question for me with regard to do we want judicial patent reform or do we want congressional patent reform is this: how will it affect the incentives to invest? And I think that a strong case can be made for the idea that the judicial version of patent reform, which focuses on the bad behavior of the few without burdening the many, is a better way to go. And I'm very concerned that if the current leading bills in the House and Senate, H.R. 9 and S. 1137, were to be enacted, we would see a large portion of the investment decisions, both internal corporate investment and outside investment, sharply curtailed, which obviously means that inventions that would have otherwise happened and cures that otherwise would have been perfected won't be, and the society would be the loser. So I'm making the pitch, of course, for continuing judicial reform with the input of the private bar and industry, rather than heavy-handed congressional aggressive interventions.
Thank you, Judge Michel. Mr. Haslam, are you on the line now?
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. So thank you for joining us, and we'll now turn to you for some opening remarks, and then we'll open it up for the floor for questions.
Okay. Well, one thing I wanted to touch on first is a point that Judge Michel made about Congress's approach to reform, and particularly the fee shifting. I think, and I've seen some commentary, that if the court adopts fee shifting for patent cases, it will not be very long before those who are interested in tort reform will begin to ask for the same mechanism in tort cases. And I think you could see at least potentially the shift, depending on the political will of Congress and depending on who is in control of Congress, you could see fee shifting as a matter of course become the way in our system. But I also wanted to back up generally and say that if you look at the history of judicial approaches to modifying and moving the law to take care of new problems and issues as they arise, if you look at the entire history of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure from the time that they were first adopted through today, and you look at the various amendments, I think that is a shining example of how the judiciary is responsive, first of all, to at the outset, opening up and making discovery more easy, because it was believed, and I think it's true, that the more information both sides have, the better able they are to resolve their problems. And if any of us have been in court in front of judges, we've probably heard it at least once in every case, that the parties themselves are better able to shape a compromise or resolution of the dispute in a better way than a jury or a judge will. But certainly either of those will be better, I think, than having Congress take an approach to it. Congress moves slowly, and it sometimes moves abruptly when it does move. But I think you would, if Congress had been in charge of implementing what the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure now govern, we may still have been stuck with something that was passed in 1938 or 1944 or 1950. So I think that's an example of why the common law approach to incremental change to the law is good. As with any reform, the devil's in the details and how it actually gets implemented. So in preparation for this, I know the Eastern District of Texas is often a whipping boy for those in favor of patent reform. But I looked at about 25 complaints that have been filed since December 1st, 2015, to compare them with what my understanding was of the kinds of patents complaints that were filed there and elsewhere that prompted a lot of the changes, particularly to the pleading rules. And what I found was very interesting, and only one of those complaints was there a failure to mention a patent and claim. In several of them, claim charts were attached to the complaint. And in all of the others, there was a reference to a specific claim and a mapping to the extent information was publicly available, including in some cases putting in the complaint screenshots or other publicly available information to underscore certain points about infringement. So I think, and in none of those cases yet, have you seen any motions to dismiss. It's fair. I looked at the dockets and almost all of those, and they were still operating on extensions of time. So my belief is given the nature of those complaints, one of the things we're going to see is a cutback on the nature on the number of motions to dismiss for lack of specificity. While I'm on the issue of the pleading changes, I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind, and I think it's something that not a lot of attention has been given to, and that is the applicability of the new, or the absence of Form 18 and therefore reversion to Iqbal and Twombly, is the application of those pleading rules either to affirmative defenses or to counterclaims. And it may come as a surprise, because it did to me, that there are some courts, particularly in the Fourth Circuit, for example, that have applied the Iqbal Twombly to affirmative defenses. And more cases have applied the heightened pleading standards to counterclaims, and in particular have struck the typical kind of counterclaim that claims for invalidity, for example, and simply says that the patents are invalid under 101, 102, 103, and 112. So I think that it's going to help on all sides, both for the patentee and those who are receiving the complaints, to get greater specificity earlier in the case. I think one thing that will be interesting to watch as it evolves is how the heightened pleading standards will apply to declaratory relief claims. And it's not exactly clear to me how one who wants to file a complaint for declaratory relief of non-infringement, what the pleading requirements are going to require for that. The other thing I think is going to be interesting to see how it evolves is the interplay between the heightened pleading standards and the new discovery rules in Rule 26. one of which, and I guess one of the primary ones, is that it now limits discovery to the claims and issues in the case. And the interrelationship that I'd be interested to see relates to one of the points that Judge Michel made, which is the advent of patent local rules in several courts. In those rules, to date, the time at which the detailed allegations of what claims, what products, and how you read the claims on the accused product typically is done at some short period of time after the initial case management conference. It will be interesting to see what the interrelationship is between complaints, which typically, at least in the examples that I reviewed, pointed out a single product, and in one case, two products, and a particular claim, is going to be the ability to broaden the scope of accused products for discovery purposes and disclosure purposes, and how the limitation to those issues which are pled in the complaint is going to act, if at all, as a limitation on the ability of patent holders to broaden the nature of the case after the filing of the complaint based on the local rules. And I think that is an issue that will play out over time, and I think the way the courts will handle that, I think, it will be satisfactory to both sides. Other than that, I do think that the judicial innovation, if I can use that term, that we've seen in particular over the last 4 or 5 years, both from the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit, in terms of case law development, I think is probably the best example and the best exhibit for why judicial innovation is preferable to congressional innovation. Congress will act, and then, as is typically its wont, will consider the problem solved, and will leave us with a set of statutory will leave us with a set of statutes which will be much harder for courts to evolve as case law and new issues arise. So I wholeheartedly concur that these things are best left to the courts rather than Congress.
Thank you. That was Judge Michel and Mr. Hoslin provided a tour de force of what is extensive and wide-ranging changes that have been made in patent law, both at the substantive level in terms of claim interpretation and what counts as patentable subject matter under Section 101, as well as with respect to litigation in terms of local pleading rules and the shift and the elimination of Form 18 and the shift to the Twombly-Iqbal standards for pleading. Mr. Hoslin provided incredible additional details on the application of Twombly and Iqbal, for instance, as it's now being applied to affirmative defenses now, which is utterly fascinating and goes under the longstanding cliche, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And so this has been a fascinating opening for our teleforum now. So I think we'll now open it up for questions from our audience. So, Dean, do you have any instructions for our audience members who wish to ask questions?
Yeah, I need to push a couple buttons here. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or all of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few people on the line. We'll start with two questions. So let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Christian from the International Center for Law and Economics. I've been following this issue, and it's interesting that the courts have already been implementing a lot of the changes that are in the proposed legislation. But when I talk to some stakeholders in the on the corporate side of the equation here, they seem to feel very enthusiastically that they need these reforms from the bills. And I can't quite figure out what those bills are going to provide them that the common law approach that you outlined is not providing them. I was wondering if you had any insight about what there might be in these bills that actually is in the interest of these companies that is not currently in the common law approach.
This is Bob. I think one of the principal things that the corporate stakeholders are interested in the bills is venue reform. And I think that it has been a goal of at least one of the sets of stakeholders agitating before Congress to get venue reform as a response to what they perceive as a troll haven in the Eastern District of Texas. Interestingly, there is a case on en banc review at the Federal Circuit now that at least raises the possibility that that venue reform, again, will be something that may be tackled by the judiciary in a way which would require a reinterpretation of the venue statutes. But I suspect that venue reform is one of the biggest things that the corporate stakeholders have interest in the legislation.
Professor, okay. I should add that the venue reform by the judiciary has been a continuing process over the last 6 or 7 years with several mandamus decisions early on requiring the transfer out of Eastern Texas of cases that plainly didn't belong there, and that trend has continued. As Mr. Haslam mentions, the Federal Circuit has yet another case in this long line which may result in an even greater change, and it's viewed as so important that they've ordered oral argument in March on this mandamus petition. So a lot is happening in the judiciary on venue changes, venue reforms, if you like, which continues a steady process begun long ago and continuing today. And, you know, the question of what would satisfy some of the stakeholders, at this point, the judiciary seems to get no credit at all from some of those stakeholders for the ongoing reforms in 6 or 8 different directions. So it makes me wonder whether some of the stakeholders aren't really hoping that there'll just be fewer lawsuits because fewer patent owners will be able to afford to enforce their patents. It seems to me that, if anything, patent litigation currently, even before the AIA actually, is too expensive, too slow, too disruptive, and too unpredictable. If the legislation passes, each one of those ills will get considerably worse. It'll become even more expensive, even slower, even more disruptive, and even more unpredictable. The effect on parties will be that patent owners that are not huge, wealthy corporations, many of them simply won't be able to stay the course and enforce their patents at all. And maybe that's the secret long-term agenda of some of the proponents of more radical reform.
Judge Michel, that raises an interesting point. If I could just interject with a follow-up question, quick follow-up question, which is, I know that you've had some experience with with trying to commercialize patents in the marketplace in recent years, and what you have described and what Mr. Haslam has also described in the patent litigation side and what you just described very briefly about kind of the ongoing changes really raises an interesting question about to what extent do changes in patent law, both on the substantive side and on the litigation side, impact litigation. I'm sure the audience well knows, patents are not tools for litigation. They're actually tools for commercializing and getting to market new technological innovation. And yet it seems that with changes in damages and changes in the ability to get injunctions and the ability and all of the other impacts and all the other changes we've had through the AIA as well, that there seems to be incentives for people now to go to litigation. Can you speak to that?
Well, let me give you a point of departure. In the 1990s, IBM licensed to thousands of companies thousands of patents, generating licensing revenues of over $1 billion a year. And they never had to file a lawsuit, because that was the era that I like to call the era of the honor system, where people using someone else's technology without being sued took licenses or engaged in cross licenses or otherwise got the permission of the owner of the patents on the technology. Nowadays, that has sharply changed. I was involved with David Kapos over the last couple of years and a handful of other people in trying to create what you could roughly consider a New York Stock Exchange for licensing patent rights. It was called Intellectual Property Exchange International. And I thought the model was good. The trading would be like on the stock exchange, totally transparent, based on bids, market would set the prices. Everybody would be able to acquire on the same terms. There'd be no secret deals and so forth. That effort looked very promising, but when they tried to license the six portfolios of high-quality patents that had been ceded to the exchange, none of the people who acknowledged they were practicing the technologies were willing to take a license. The business people in the technology users wanted to take a license because the prices were extremely low. But at the CEO level, or more often after consulting outside counsel, the companies changed their mind and decided not to take licenses, because in every case, they told us that their outside counsel told them, don't take a license. It doesn't matter whether you think the patent is valid. It doesn't matter that you are sure you are using it and therefore you are infringing. You don't need to take a license. They may not be able to even file a lawsuit. If they do file a lawsuit, just call us and we'll defend you, starting with an IPR, and we'll probably outlast the patent owner. So we were so stunned by this development with regard to the several dozen people using these six portfolios that we had our staff leaders ask other outside counsel for other parties if they were giving the same advice to their clients on a routine basis. And in every case, we were told, yes, we tell our clients, don't license, don't negotiate, fight it out, and you'll probably prevail. And if the patent owner ultimately gets paid, it'll be 8 years from now, and the amount won't be probably very great. Anyway, so we've gone from the honor system to the dishonor system, where not always, but routinely, patent rights are disregarded by users of technology, and I think it's a very sad development.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got one question pending, and then our lines are wide open, so push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi. Thank you for this really interesting talk. It seems that both of our experts today, and probably the moderator as well, agree that the efforts in the courts have been more precise and better targeted at the problem of a few people. And I was just curious what you all think of the effort in state legislatures to go after a few bad actors by creating a state right of action to fight it out in state court that someone is filing a bad faith claim of patent infringement.
Well, this is Judge Michelle. If I threaten you with a lawsuit on a patent that I don't even own, or a patent that's been declared invalid or unenforceable, or engage in other such fraudulent conduct, I certainly should be subject to severe sanctions. So I'm perfectly fine with state legislation that would strengthen the ability of state authorities to crack down on dishonest demand letters. I think it may be a little bit tricky to talk about a bad faith unless it's very carefully defined in some objective way, because of course no one can get inside the brain of somebody who sends a demand letter. But certainly if the demand letter contains assertions that are simply false and therefore fraudulent, that would justify severe penalties. And not only at the state level, but very likely at the federal level, because the Federal Trade Commission has considerable consumer protection authority under Section 5 of its statute, and it actually has exercised that authority against at least one sender of irresponsible and, I guess, fraudulent demand letters in very large numbers. So federal and state authorities certainly have both have a role in this arena, as long as it's carefully defined, because every year thousands of demand letters are sent by perfectly responsible, sober actors, demand letters that have a sound basis. So, we don't want to overreact to a few abuses and wreck the whole system that industry needs in order to trade these rights and disseminate these technologies as widely as possible.
I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't have assumed that you have necessarily looked at the legislation that is sort of bubbling around in the various state legislatures. I mean, at least speaking for the bill that's being considered in New Jersey, it doesn't go to actual fraudulent claims. It is tied more to just sort of a host of factors, including sort of a lack of specificity and the fact that the person making the claim may not actually be using the patent, and a sort of a variety of other sort of factors that I guess sometimes correlate to what are considered to be, you know, patent trolls, but not actually turning on the merits of the underlying claim.
Yeah, this is Bob. I tend to think that a host of states, because we will probably get a hodgepodge of state regulations if they do it. That's generally been the way states go about regulation. I think it is going to suffer the same problems that I think I foresee with Congress trying to act, and that is it'll be a one size fits all. And for example, on the lack of specificity, it is, I think, perfectly proper for somebody with a patent who believes that another company may be using it, but it's the nature of the patent that you cannot tell from a publicly available product that it does or doesn't infringe. To send a letter that says, we have patents, we notice you've got XYZ products, we'd like to sit down and talk to you about whether or not our patents might be of use to you. It sounds to me like possibly, depending on how you define lack of specificity, that could be deemed under an extreme view of the kind of legislation that you're talking about, could be deemed to be a demand letter that has a lack of specificity or whatever. So I think the bad trolls will get taken care of in the courts, and that having a variety of states is just going to add, I think, unnecessary litigation to a process, patent litigation, which we're trying to move in the opposite direction to make it more efficient.
I also think that this is an excellent question and an excellent issue. And as a professor who's actually testified on the hearing for the House on the Troll Act, which was a clarification of the FTC's authority to punish the bad actors who file fraudulent and deceptive demand letters, which by the way was it's somewhat unnecessary because the Federal Trade Commission has already taken action against one particular bad actor, the one that engaged in the activities in Vermont, MPHJ. This is a clarification and actually a setting down in clear language what some of the standards are. But more broadly, this should be of interest and concern to Federalist Society members because this relates to exactly why patents and copyrights were put into the Constitution in the first place, because there were state laws on patents and copyrights under the Articles of Confederation, and the problem was that they had varying protection and varying requirements and varying remedies for infringement and varying punishments for improper use of them. And the founders and the framers in particular were convinced that by people like Noah Webster of Webster's Dictionary and Fitch of one of the very first steamboat inventors, that these were national products, services, and creative works that needed a national stable protection in order for there to be a successful free market in this country between the states. And in fact, following from this in the 19th century, in response to what at those times was an extreme amount of public policy debate over the creation of new technological innovation that was secured by patents that led to patent wars, and there were many people who were upset by patent owners suing them, very similar to today. All of our claims and arguments today have occurred before many times over. People went to their state legislatures in the 19th century and actually convinced state legislatures to pass laws that burdened patent owners' ability to go to federal court to sue to protect their property rights. And the federal courts in the 19th century very consistently, particularly in the late 19th century, held that those state laws were preempted by the placement of patents and copyrights as federal property rights in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution. And so I think that insofar as the state laws that are being considered in New Jersey and elsewhere that speak to issues outside of direct fraudulent and deceptive practices by certain bad actors in the patent system, certain patent owners like MPHA, that you would raise very similar concerns and problems with those state laws as the courts addressed in the 19th century.
You know, Professor Mossoff, once again, I have to ask, what's the scope and size and scale of the problem? In all the years since demand letters became a hot topic of comment in the press and in legislators, state and federal, to my recollection, only one or two bad actors were acted against by state attorneys general or by the Federal Trade Commission. Well, every year, thousands of companies send notice or demand letters or whatever we want to call them. So this is a 1% problem. If it's a 1% problem, it ought to have a 1% scale solution, not a 100% scale solution where every company would be hindered in their ability to communicate about their patent rights by legislation such as the caller describes in New Jersey. A very unfortunate circumstance. And totally
exactly.
Unnecessary given the relative rarity of the bad actor abuses.
Exactly, Judge Michel. And I could not have said it better than how you just framed it. And this is an instance where, unfortunately, rhetoric seems to trump actual data and actual facts about what is occurring with respect to patent litigation and patent licensing and the commercial exploitation of patents in today's high-tech economy, which was brought to us by the patent system itself. Dean, do we have any other callers on the line?
We have one more question pending. Let's see if we can squeeze this final question in now.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone who's participating. This is Janann Glasgow-George, and I'm a patent attorney in North Carolina. We work a lot with entrepreneurs and small mid-sized entities, and we are seeing that while the patent troll is an effective term, the value of patents, you know, being a fundamental right, property right for inventors and for startups and for small mid-sized companies, the patent reform seems to directly impair and at least reduce the value, not only of their patent rights, but of their business endeavors. It's more difficult to obtain good valuations. It seems very short-sighted for large entities to undermine the patent system with this dishonor of patents that we've heard described earlier. It may result in lower values for licensing or acquisitions even later, and that each of these large entities may have a greater value of using the patents themselves against their large ND competitors. Does anyone have a comment on perceived or data that supports the impact on the U.S. economy longer term beyond this sort of impact we see on entrepreneurs and small mid-sized companies now? Is there a shift to foreign litigation instead of in the United States? And then my final question, if I may, is who is really effectively advocating for entrepreneurial small entity inventor rights in the U.S.? Thank you.
Professor Mossov, let me take the second question and leave the first to others. The amount of money that has been spent on Capitol Hill in the form of public relations campaigns, lobbying campaigns, fly-ins of CEOs, campaign contributions, and the like is just astonishingly huge. And it has gone on for the better part of a decade, sharply escalated in the last several years, actually, ironically, since the passage of the AIA. And as a result, the small number of very big high-tech companies, nearly all in Silicon Valley, their voice is heard with huge magnification or amplification on Capitol Hill. And the voices and needs of smaller companies, of small business in general, of startups, of university spinoffs, research institutes, hospitals, and the like, I think has not been able to penetrate the din and get an appropriate hearing. So the interest of a very small number of very big, very angry, very rich, very persistent companies is driving the whole process. You know, we've got 30,000 commercial companies in the United States with at least 100 employees each. 30,000. This whole patent reform legislation is being driven by fewer than 50 of that 30,000 companies, and the others are not getting, in my view, a fair hearing.
May I ask one quick follow-up question? We've also noticed that even with the judicial actions, or if you will, as we were saying, the common law advancement in the laws with the post-Alice and how that's been handled by the USPTO, it has had a very chilling effect on the approval of patents, mostly as we hear it from patent examiners as having a lack of direction. And as PTO guidelines have been updated at least once, that seems to have improved slightly. But from our numbers, we've seen less than 1,000 patents granted following an Alice 101 rejection since the Alice case and the guidelines at PTO. That's also having a really negative impact on the small and mid-sized companies, independent inventors who aren't perhaps as well funded to take on longer prosecutions to manage this issue inside PTO.
Well, it's pretty ironic that the Kauffman Foundation and the U.S. Census Bureau in multiple studies not long ago found that most net new jobs are created by small companies and startups, most technological breakthroughs created by the very same class of actors, and that most economic growth is a result of their innovations and their successes. So it looks to me like we are crimping the very most productive sector of our corporate community, which just seems like exactly what we should not be doing.
Well, Adam, this is Dean. I think we're just about out of time. We might have 30 seconds or so for each of our guests to express a final thought if they have one.
Judge Michel?
Well, my plea would be for everyone to get involved. Startups, venture capitalists, all the different industrial sectors, all the users of patents, the investment community, everybody, so that we can have patent reform, if it's to be through legislation that's truly balanced, truly targeted at actual abuses, and doesn't unnecessarily burden the vast majority of people who are responsible, productive actors.
Excellent. Mr. Hoslin?
Yeah, I would echo that. And to the last point about Alice and the value of patents, given what's happened in damage law or whatever, I guess what I would say is I still think that the judicial approach to the evolution of the patent laws is preferable to congressional action. And I would suggest that while it may take a long time, the pendulum on the Alice, it'll be interesting to see if it ever begins to swing back towards the middle. As one judge said, you can abstract any invention down to the point where it is basically something you can say has existed for a long time. Almost any patent relating to anything in buying or selling, you can say is essentially buying and selling, which has been around for, you know, for however long. So I think it will be interesting to see if, and if so, when the pendulum may swing back on exactly how abstract one can legitimately abstract inventions for purposes of Alice.
Well, thank you. Well, this has been a really fascinating and interesting discussion about patent litigation and the strengths of the patent system and the ways in which patents are being impacted today by past and current proposed changes, both in Congress and in the states and by the judiciary itself. So thank you to our guests, Judge Michelle and Mr. Haslam, for their excellent comments, and thank you to the audience for the great questions. Dean?
Well, let me add my thanks to our participants here and include you, Professor Adam Mossoff. We certainly appreciate you participating and joining us today. And thanks to the audience for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's website and be alert to emails for our next scheduled telephone conference call, which as of now is 2 p.m. on Friday Eastern Time. We'll be talking about foreign intelligence collection. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.